Good evening, this is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720 and to one of the most interesting men in the country with one of the most interesting careers, but one that the country knew little about as he enjoyed that career. The man I'm talking about is Lieutenant General Vernon Walters, U.S. Army retired, who ended his active career in public service as the Deputy Director of the CIA. But for the many years before that, played a very important, often behind-the-scenes role, assisting major American diplomats and American presidents in their travels around the world. General Walters has been military attaché in Brazil, in Rome, in Paris. He had an important intelligence role in the Vietnam War, a very important relationship with Presidents Kennedy, Nixon, Eisenhower, and in his years as Deputy Director of the CIA, he found himself involved in the great Watergate affair. Indeed, we must talk, perhaps even at the beginning of our conversation, about the attempt to get General Walters, representing the CIA, to call off the FBI, all that was revealed in the final smoking gun tape that brought down the president. We will be on to that discussion with General Vernon Walters right after an update on the evening's news. Our guest tonight, and a great honor to have him here, Lieutenant General Vernon Walters, U.S. Army retired, who, at the culmination of a distinguished career of public service, was the Deputy Director of the CIA for a few years. General Walters, bienvenue à Chicago, willkommen, buonasera, and that's where I run out. I really don't speak any language but English, but you speak eight languages, the most linguistically sophisticated general officer in the U.S. Army, I would imagine.
Well, no, it's about the same number of languages that a good concierge in a European hotel speaks or a good head waiter in a restaurant.
To be sure, but they don't usually rise to three or four stars on their shoulders. Your linguistic ability was the key to your early preferment and success as an enlisted man.
Not as an enlisted man.
Well, rather in your rapid translation from the ranks of enlisted man to officer.
No, actually it played no part. When I came into the Army, they were commissioning the president of General Motors as a lieutenant general. This was 1941, before we entered the war. And David Sarnoff of RCA, a brigadier general, so I thought they'd probably make me a major. Instead, they made me a truck driver.
Well, but within 6 months, you had been to officers'
13 months.
Was it 13?
13 months. I rose in various enlisted ranks and finally went. I came in May 41, and I went to officers' candidate school in February 42.
There was a lovely moment early in your career and towards the beginning of the war, or were we not yet in the war? I forget. I guess this happened in about 42. We were in the war. When you suddenly got a command, in essence, to learn Portuguese overnight so that you could do some translating for a Brazilian military mission that was coming up to be impressed by our preparedness.
Well, I was a little earlier than that. It was the Portuguese, actually.
The Portuguese came first, then the Brazilians
Because we were very anxious to get the Azores bases. The German submarines were sinking 1 million tons of shipping a month, which was more than we could build. And I'd come back from North Africa, and I was teaching prisoner of war interrogation at a military intelligence school. And this colonel called me from the Pentagon, and he said, Lieutenant, we want you down here tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock to take a Portuguese group around, and it's very important because we have to impress them that we're going to win the war. And I said, Colonel, I'm afraid there's some misunderstanding. I don't speak Portuguese. And he said, nah, but you speak French and Spanish and Italian, all that stuff. You'll understand it. I said, Colonel, I've heard them, and I don't. I've heard Portuguese, and I don't understand it. He said, Lieutenant, there is a misunderstanding. You seem to think I'm inviting you to be here tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. I'm not.
The Army was the Army.
The Army was the Army.
Back then, as it still is. Yeah. And you managed to
handle
that delegation in a version of Portuguese the very next day.
Not quite. They all spoke Spanish and French, too. And actually, Portuguese and Spanish are a little further apart than, say, American and English. It really isn't like learning another language. It's like, you know, about 80% of the words are immediately recognized.
In fact, that touring Portuguese delegation took you under their collective wing, and they taught you Portuguese on that trip, didn't they?
They did. They were very patient. And then right after that, the Brazilians came, and they'd written such a nice letter that everybody thought I really spoke Portuguese, and they sent for me the second time, and I went around with them for about 3 months, and by that time, I was getting along in Portuguese.
General Walters, it was a long, distinguished, and fascinating career, and it is reported in an utterly engrossing new book of yours, and I might as well instantly give the title, Silent Missions by Vernon A. Walters, has just been published by Doubleday. And I want to go to the end of the book at the beginning of the program.
Everybody does.
I imagine they do. You come up in a very interesting way in the famous smoking gun tape, the one which finally, when released and revealed, brought Mr. Nixon down. I hope you'll indulge me while I read some passages from that dialogue between Messrs. Haldeman and Nixon. And some of this doesn't make too much sense because it turns out that even when expletives weren't deleted, they didn't always speak in absolutely syntactically perfected full sentences. All the same, Haldeman says, "Now, on the investigation," he's talking to the president, "you know, the Democratic break-in thing, we're back in the problem area because the FBI is not under control, because Gray," the director of the FBI at that time, "because Gray doesn't exactly know how to control it, and they have, their investigation is now leading into some productive areas because they've been able to trace the money, and it goes in some directions we don't want it to go. Mitchell came up with yesterday, and John Dean analyzed very carefully last night, and concurs now with Mitchell's recommendation, that the only way to solve this, and we're set up beautifully to do it, is for us to have Walters," that's Vernon Walters, "is for us to have Walters call Pat Gray, the head of the FBI, and just say, quote, stay the hell out of this. This is a business here. We don't want you to go any further on it. That's not an unusual development, and that would take care of it." Nixon, "What about Pat Gray? You mean Pat Gray doesn't want to?" Haldeman, "Pat does want to. He doesn't know how to, and he doesn't have any basis for doing it. Given this, he will then have the basis. He'll call Mark Felt in, his assistant, and the two of them, and Mark Felt wants to cooperate because he's ambitious." Nixon, "Yeah." "He'll call him in and he'll say, we've got the signal from across the river," that is from the CIA, "to put the hold on this. And that will fit rather well because the FBI agents who are working the case at this point feel that's what it is." Nixon goes on, "When you get in, people say, look," and he's instructing Haldeman what they want Haldeman to get you to say to Pat Gray. "You are supposed to say, look, the problem is that this will open the whole Bay of Pigs thing. And the president just feels that without getting into the details, don't lie to them to the extent to say no involvement, but just say, this is a comedy of errors. Without getting into it, the president believes that it is going to open the whole Bay of Pigs things up, and because these people are plugging for unintelligible, and that they should call the FBI in and unintelligible, don't go any further into this case, period." That is a little garbled, as I say, syntactically, but it's clear that what the president is approving is Haldeman's plan to get you as the deputy director of the CIA to call off the FBI, and when that tape finally was revealed, that was the end. A day or two after that, Mr. Nixon gave us his resignation. You did go to Pat Gray, and in the first conversation, you, in essence, followed Haldeman's script, didn't you?
Not quite the way it's described in the book. The book sounds as if it was my instructions were to call off the whole investigation. Those were not the instructions that Haldeman gave
me. It was to call off the Mexican angle.
The Mexican. Now, the important thing to remember in this, there's a couple of things that need background in this. Great attention was focused by many of the media on the fact that I did go to Pat Gray. And quite frankly, if I'd done anything really wrong, I wouldn't have still been in office 3.5 years later. Now, the background is this. For 3 years, I'd been in the CIA for 6 weeks at this point. I'd come back from 10 years overseas service. In Paris, for 3.5 years, I had been running for the president secret negotiations with both the North Vietnamese and the Chinese communists. And I was communicating...
You were the man who first knocked on the door of
the
Chinese in Paris.
That's right.
To begin our contacts.
And I was sending back coded messages through the embassy in Paris that I was encoding myself. I used to say that I was the most high-paid code clerk in the U.S. government. I was a major general at the time. Now, the first thought when Haldeman called me in, he didn't just call me, he also called Helms. And what he said to me is to tell the FBI to call off the investigation in Mexico because it may uncover some CIA assets or operations. Now, the CIA is a large organization, and neither the director nor I would know the details of every single operation. Two things came to my mind. Quite frankly, and I say so in my book, the idea that the chief of staff of the president was going to ask me to do something illegal or wrong, perhaps it sounds naive in the light of what everybody knows now, but if you challenged every order you got, you couldn't run the government business. The next thought was, if they'd asked me to call off the whole investigation, I might have been suspicious. I had never heard the word Mexico used in connection with the Watergate or the laundry of the money. None of that had appeared yet. I knew nothing about it. It was as if they'd asked me to call off the investigation in Liechtenstein. It was not connected with any fact of which I was aware at that time. Now, on the basis that this was a legitimate thing, I did go to Pat Gray and ask him to lay off the investigation in Mexico since it might uncover. The thought that occurred to me was they've got something going with Castro in Mexico City, like I had with the Chinese and the North Vietnamese in Paris. And you must remember, in retrospect, that in this kind of an area, no one had ever challenged the president's powers before to do this sort of thing. I mean, there are many cases of it before Watergate where this sort of thing was done. So I went to Pat Gray. This was a Friday afternoon. Now, I had some wonder about this, so when I got back to the CIA later that afternoon, I called in our people who dealt with the Western Hemisphere, and I said, are there any messages coming out of the embassy in Mexico City which we are not reading? Because that was the situation in Paris where I was encoding my own messages. And if there were, that would confirm my suspicions that there was something going on of this type. Now, they checked and they said, no, we are reading all the traffic coming from Mexico City. I said, now, I want you to go back, and Helms did this parallel himself, and check and see if there is anything we've got going there that could in any way be embarrassed by the FBI's investigation of this case, about which I knew nothing about Dahlberg or the money at this time. This was not concluded Friday night. It went on Saturday, and Monday morning, I got a call from Mr. Dean. And I didn't know who Mr. Dean was. I never had any contact with Mr. Dean.
Big Bad John over at the White House.
And I don't know whether he's Big Bad John or not, but I mean, he didn't impress me as being very big, for one thing.
You say in your book that you felt just a small degree of annoyance at being called in by a man half your age.
That is an understatement. I felt pretty irritated, to tell you the truth. And he called me rather peremptorily. And he said, well, if you don't want to talk to me, call Ehrlichman, and he'll tell you that I'm in charge of this case. So I called Ehrlichman. Ehrlichman said, yes, Dean's in touch with everybody, with Gray, with you, with everybody. I went down on Monday, the next working day after I had been to Pat Gray. And Dean received me, and he said, well, what's the agency involvement? I said, there isn't any. I've looked into this. He said, there must be. I said, there isn't. He said, well, there's got to be. I said, Mr. Dean, the director and I have both looked into this in great detail, and there isn't any. We have no interest in this. There are no assets of ours that can in any way be exposed. None of our representatives.
There's no embarrassment that
there's
can
no
be
caused embarrassment for us
to the CIA if the FBI goes down to look into the
we
Mexican
We have no
angle.
Interest in this matter whatsoever. Now, again, you will say I was naive. He told me he was in daily contact with Pat Gray, and I presumed he would tell this to Pat Gray, that he was coordinating the whole thing, that he checked with me. Helms and I had checked carefully, and there was no connection. That was a naive mistake, and I say so quite frankly in the book.
In that same meeting, or if not in that conversation, the first of the three, then in the second and the third, he asked some other things of
you. Yes, he did.
He asked for the CIA to, in essence, pay the hush money to the Watergate
Correct.
Burglars.
Correct.
He also, well, you tell me, what else
well,
was he asking?
He did not ask me that the first day. He kept emphasizing that there must be some CIA and that we should be wary and this, that, and the other. I said, Mr. Dean, there is no way this can embarrass us. There is no agency connection with this. And he seemed satisfied. That lasted maybe 15, 20 minutes. The next morning, Tuesday, I get another call from him. And he says, these people are wobbling. I said, let them wobble. It's of no interest to us. And he said, they may talk. I said, fine, let them talk. He said, is there any way in which you could possibly, they're looking for help, and they need help, and we want to help them. Is there any way in which you could pay their bail and their salaries out of secret CIA funds? I said, no way, Mr. Dean. Absolutely not. The only value that this agency has to the government is its nonpartisan character.
Now, General, there's another fascinating angle here. Mr. Dean also, in one of those three conversations, tried to get from you an answer to this question. Was the CIA in any way involved in setting up the Watergate or in setting up the discovery of the break-in? You, of course, gave him a strong, clear assurance
that... No, he did not ask me that question. He did not ask me. He asked me, is the CIA involved in this? And I said, no. Involved in setting it up, he never asked.
Well, then I'm jumping ahead, because what I've also got in mind is another man that you've already mentioned and who has been a guest on this program, namely John Ehrlichman.
Yeah.
And the fascinating hypothesis laid out in Ehrlichman's novel, to be sure it is a novel, a roman de clé.
Sans clé.
Sans clé. Perhaps we'd better translate.
No key.
Well, Ehrlichman, of course, when you ask him, isn't this based on life, laughs and says, no, it's pure fiction. But a president, Richard Monckton, who looks and sounds very much like Richard Nixon, is brought down by a CIA plot. A CIA plot not unlike the Watergate break-in.
Well, that's the Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Colson thesis.
Well, I want to...
I might add that at this first meeting, Ehrlichman was present, and in a recent magazine illustration, he was shown sitting at the desk and doing all the talking. He never opened his mouth from the beginning to the end. And Mr. Haldeman wasn't sitting at a desk. Apparently, he had a back problem, and he had one of these stand-up desks. As I said at the Urban Committee, their testimony and mine vary, and I will stand on my recollections of this. There was no CIA connection with this. What happened, apparently, is whoever set this up. You see, there's one thing I think that should be clear about the CIA, which most people don't understand. The average person tends to think of the CIA as a huge, tightly knit, monolithic institution in which everybody thinks the same way. If you could have been present at some of the discussions I've had with the analysts, it was a knockdown, drag-out fight on many subjects. If you asked me the political composition, and I would estimate this as my guess, I would say it's roughly 60% Democratic and 40% Republican. And you've had these things about it was used against Kennedy in some way or it was used against Nixon. The fact is that the majority and the minority are both so large that if there was any attempt to do this, the place would blow apart. I was, after all, a Nixon appointee. I wasn't going to let them plot against him. I mean, that's nonsense, and I've told Mr. Nixon that. You think this happened, and you're wrong. It didn't.
Does Mr. Nixon still think that the CIA had a hand in bringing him down?
I think he may have a harbor, a suspicion of that. You know, when you've had something terrible like this happen to you, you're always looking for some rational explanation. Now, the most generally advanced thing is that most of these people were former CIA employees.
To be sure.
Well, these people were intelligence operatives who'd operated against the enemy of the United States overseas, and they'd had some experience. If you're going to get a security guard, you're going to look for a former policeman or someone like that to do it. And if he does it, it doesn't mean that the police department he worked for previously is guilty. And there's been a guilt by association, which McCarthy used successfully at the other political extreme, done in this, that because these people were former CIA employees, that therefore the CIA must have been in some way involved.
Well, the CIA has come in for a lot of hard knocks over recent years. Only a few months ago, I heard Admiral Turner make a presentation to a small private group in Chicago in which he assured us that whatever sins may have been committed before his time, they had now all been expunged and the agency was totally transformed and would be absolutely letter-perfect loyal to the last jot and tittle of the law as the law ought to be applied in CIA operations. We've got to pause right now and take care of some commercial messages. When we come back, I'd love to get your overall estimate, before we turn to other aspects of your fascinating career, but your overall summary judgment about where, if at all, the CIA did err and whether now it has, in fact, been properly cleansed and or properly reformed. Right back to General Vernon Walters after these words. And General Walters, I don't want to give the wrong impression to our listeners. Your new book, Silent Missions, is not, of course, a book about Watergate. It's only the next to the last chapter which deals with Watergate, and that only for the space of some 60 pages out of a total of over 600, every one of them enthralling. You've lived a fascinating life, and you describe it very vividly. But lingering with the Watergate matter for just a moment, and then getting on to the CIA, and then getting back to all the rest of your exciting, one might almost say romantic, career, it is the case, as I remember it, that though directly after your meeting with Haldeman and Ehrlichman, you did go to Pat Gray and tell him, call off the Mexican side of the operation. Once you assured yourself back at Langley that there were no potential Mexican embarrassments, you got in touch with Pat Gray again, didn't you?
No, I told Dean, presuming that Dean would tell him, not realizing that he wouldn't. I mean, you know, it's easy to say now you should have known that, but I had no way of knowing that this sort of thing was building and developing. At the end of the week, Pat Gray called me about a week later and said, look, I can't stop this. And I was dumbfounded, unless I have a letter from you in writing that there's a CIA interest. And I was dumbfounded that he hadn't been told by Dean. And I went to see him and I said, Pat, there's no way I can tell you any such thing. I've looked into this matter carefully. There is absolutely no CIA interest. So even with Dean's failing to tell him, there was only a one-week lapse there, and only in the investigation in Mexico, not anywhere else. The investigation was continuing everywhere else.
Wasn't it about Pat Gray that Ehrlichman got off his famous line, let's leave him hanging, twisting in the wind, or something of the sort?
Yes. I feel quite sorry for Pat Gray. I think he was a fine, upright man, and he was caught in a very difficult circumstance. I was fortunate. Dean sent for me three times. And that was the only pressure on me. When I told him no, that I would resign, and we didn't get to my third meeting with him when he called me the third day, and he pressed me again. And I said, there's no way. Absolutely not. We would destroy the agency. And he said, well, what shall we do? And for some reason that is obscure to me, he hasn't covered this in his book, although he did cover it in his congressional testimony, and it's there in the record. And I said, fire everybody connected with this. And he looked at me and he whispered and he waved his finger at me and he said, no one is going to be fired. I said, then, Mr. Dean, what is now a small, painful, conventional explosion will become a multi-megaton hydrogen bomb, and people who are not now touched will be. And I met the president. Now, at the second meeting, when he made this suggestion, I went home and started to write memoranda of conversation because I could see we were getting into very deep areas. And I believe I'm the only person involved in this whole case who had any memoranda regarding these conversations.
Well, you have your memoranda. The White House bunch have their tapes, of course.
Yes, but I would like to point out one thing, that I was perhaps the only person involved in this whole matter who was still in office 3.5 years later.
You didn't leave the agency until
1976. And I must have been before and testified 30 times before congressional boards, special prosecutors, non-special prosecutors, and House committees, Senate committees, and so forth. I think in all fairness, it should be pointed out that the CIA was the only U.S. government agency, to my knowledge right now, that did not do what it was asked in this case.
This is WGN, Clear Channel Radio from Chicago. I invited you a moment ago, General Walters, to give us your overall evaluation of the CIA's failures and success, its lapses from the letter of the law and the restoration of the law. But before we get to that, it occurs to me I should really ask you, since we've been talking about Watergate, I should really ask you to give me your overall evaluation and your overall best guess or best reconstruction as to what that affair was really about. You are, after all, a specialist in intelligence. You were second in command of our major intelligence agency. Taking your skills and your understanding of the shadowy background forces that often move certain events toward public scrutiny, what is your best estimate at this late date about what the original break-in was about?
Well, now, let me not pose under false colors. All of my intelligence experience has been in foreign intelligence.
To be sure. I'm just asking for your judgment.
I would say that in this case, there was the most incredible stupidity. It was so stupid that I couldn't conceive that the president would know about it. I just couldn't conceive. For instance, you have the Democratic National Committee occupying many rooms in the Watergate. How would anybody know which room to bug? What would they expect to get there? The election was apparently clearly won. I mean, just the most monumental stupidity, and I have said many times that in my belief this was a middle-level White House operation somewhere. I don't know who. I really don't know who. And when they got in trouble, they reached up for help to Haldeman and Ehrlichman. When Haldeman and Ehrlichman got in trouble, they reached up for help to the president. And he, through misguided loyalty or something else, decided to help them. It was just an incredible piece of stupidity. You know, he didn't need to do this. They didn't need to do this. They had the election in their pocket. I'd been back. I'd been 10 years overseas, and I said to Dean, I said, there's just no way you can float this thing. There's just no way it'll go. And he seemed satisfied, and I must say, and you know, you like to put the record straight, when Mr. Dean was testifying, they asked him, did you ask General Walters to do this? Yes. What did he say? He said, no, he wouldn't do it. Now, you see, the emphasis has been given to the fact that I went to Gray through ignorance and naivete, but when I had able to look at the matter, I did not. He then said, I went to Ehrlichman and said, Walters won't play ball. Ehrlichman said, Walters won't play ball. He forgets how he got that job.
Mr. Nixon put him there.
Well,
was the meeting.
Henry Kissinger principally put me there because of the secret negotiations and the successfully carried out with the Chinese, and because at that time I was the senior serving officer in intelligence. I had been in intelligence longer than any other officer in the United States Armed Forces. I believe, I'm not positive, but I think so. Continuous assignments. And that job was normally occupied by an Army officer. I was, after all, a major general under President Johnson. I was not picked out of nowhere for that job. In that job, I came there from an overseas assignment. Now, Mr. Ehrlichman said, he forgets how he got that job, go back and lean on him. Now, what irritated me is a large part of the media cut off the wire story, the wire service story at that point. Had they read the rest of the wire service story or Mr. Dean's testimony, the next sentence he said was, I was embarrassed to go back to General Walters. He had been so explicit and convincing the first time. Now, very little publicity has been given to that rather important phrase. I had convinced him, A, that the CIA had nothing to do with it, and B, that I was not going to do what he asked.
Let me move on to the CIA itself. After the Watergate affair had played itself through, we had the Rockefeller special investigation, the Church Committee Senate investigation, and certainly documentation of some important charges and some important criticisms. A good deal of involvement in domestic operations, even though the CIA's mandate
but
required...
But much less than was implied.
Well, that's what I want to get you talking about. Assassination programs, plotting to overthrow governments, in general, a sense that the CIA had grown too big, too ambitious, had become, in a way, an alternate government.
That's absolute rubbish. The CIA is a highly disciplined organization, and anything the CIA did, you can be pretty sure they were sure that the president of the National Security Council wanted it. Now, if I can have a minute, I would like to talk about intelligence. There's a very ambivalent American attitude about intelligence, that it isn't American, that it's immoral, and we shouldn't be engaging in it, and that the founding fathers didn't do it. Well, that's nonsense. But the law that created the Central Intelligence Agency was extremely vague. You've talked several times about the letter of the law. There isn't any law which says what it can do. All the law says was that it will do such other things as the National Security Council may direct. Now, you mentioned such things as break-ins and so forth. Let's be specific about that. There is only one person in the United States government who has levied on him a charge by law, by a vote of the Congress, that he must protect his sources and his methods. The president doesn't have it. The Secretary of Defense doesn't have it. I don't believe the Secretary of the FBI has it. Only the Director of Central Intelligence. Now, if you interpret that law correctly, that would authorize him to do almost anything. Now, nearly all of the break-ins that were given such publicity were against CIA people who were suspected of taking home documents or being in touch with the enemy. We've had a wiretap story that gave the impression that the CIA was listening to everybody. I believe there were 32 wiretaps by the CIA in 30 years. Nearly all directed against CIA people, again suspected of disloyalty or communicating with the enemy. Then we had the mail opening. The impression was the CIA was reading everybody's mail. All of the mail open was going to or coming from the Soviet Union, its satellites, or the Chinese People's Republic, and you can be sure of one thing, that mail had been opened by somebody else either before or afterwards. Now, everybody says, oh, but they shouldn't be doing this. But you know, if you look in our national history, this has been going on forever. The fact is, you cannot run an intelligence agency which is charged with clandestinely obtaining foreign intelligence.
That's on the intelligence side, General, but what about the clandestine operations, the operations section designed to have strong political influence and to alter the course of affairs in other nations?
But the CIA...
What about the actual attempts to pull down, apparently some successful attempts to pull down governments elsewhere?
But every country does this, not just the United States. Every country has done this throughout history. This is not anything big or new. How do you think we got Hawaii? How do you think we staged a coup and overthrew the Queen of Hawaii? How did we get Texas from Mexico? How did we get California? How did we get the Panama Canal?
Well, interestingly, though, President Carter, and resonating to him, Admiral Turner, the current head of the CIA, have essentially disavowed any further operations of that sort.
Well, the CIA, and this is one thing that has been an enormous amount of falsehood told. The CIA is a highly disciplined government. And I wasn't there during the years of all of these other things that you're talking about, other than the Watergate. But I am positive that none of these were undertaken without some kind of direction from the government. Let me just give an experience that happened to me when I first went to the CIA. I was called to the White House for a meeting. The director was out of the country, and I was the acting director. And there was a White House Special Action Group meeting around the table. And I made an intelligence presentation, and then Dr. Kissinger, who was presiding as the National Security Council representative, went around the table. I presented several options that the U.S. could do and what the consequences of each one would be. And he went around to defense, to treasury, to state, to the Joint Chiefs, what do you feel? And they would each stage the option they preferred. I was new, and I wasn't as sophisticated as I should be. And he went around the table, and I thought I saw his finger point to me. And I said, option three. He said, you and intelligence have no vote. You present the options, but you don't take part in the policy decision. And this is something that is misunderstood. All these nonsensical books like Secret Government and everything else. The CIA has no force of its own. Let me make it plain. The CIA is perhaps the only intelligence service in the world that has no police power. You hear all this talk about Gestapo and GPU. It can't arrest anybody. Now, let me just give you one final fact. In the years since it was founded, some 80,000 people have passed through the CIA. 80,000. Not at any one time, you understand. This is the total number of people that have been there. With the single exception of Richard Helms, and let's take Richard Helms aside for a minute, not one of them has ever been condemned for any action threatening the freedom of the American people. Not one of them has ever even been indicted. Now, even if you hold this myth of the great secret power of the CIA, it can't control every grand jury in the United States. I would say that the CIA's record in these matters would stack up very favorably alongside of health, education, and welfare or the Department of Agriculture.
Well, maybe you can tell us the size of the CIA budget as compared to health, education, and welfare or the Department of Agriculture. One thing that we don't know and would like to know about the CIA is how much of our money does it spend?
The United States Congress, in three occasions in the last year I was at CIA, specifically forbade that figure from being made plain.
I know that.
If I were to do it, I would break the law. I would also break an oath that I took, and I have no intention of doing so this late in my career.
Even though it would be a great scoop for me at the moment.
Even though it would be a great scoop if I would tell you. No intelligence service in the world, in any democratic country such as Great Britain, Switzerland, socialist Sweden, or anywhere else, publishes such a figure. Now, let me just give you an interesting thought about that. If that figure were given once, it wouldn't really do any harm. The Capitol dome wouldn't come coming down. But if you had a large program, like the U-2, like the raising of the submarine, you would get a bulge in that budget in that year that would inevitably tell the other side that there was something up and they would begin looking for it. You see, every time you divulge an intelligence method, you destroy it. Let me give you an example. I said to the Israelis after Entebbe, you know, by letting that movie made, there's something you'll never be able to do again. And they said, what's that? I said, in that movie, it showed that the Israelis knew that there were no explosives in the boxes around the terminal in Kampala because they'd questioned a hostage that had been freed in Paris. I said, the one thing you make sure is that they'll not free the hostages again. You know, it's very difficult to discuss intelligence in the same level as anything else. We are engaged in an invisible war against us, which is being fought with forces 10 times the size of ours. You've seen it. The Dutch threw out a bunch of people the other day. We had this Vietnamese spy here today corrupting somebody or trying to corrupt somebody in the U.S. Information Agency to give him a telegram. If you have an original telegram, you can go back and work on the code and get more than just what was in that telegram. There is an invisible battle going on that the American people as a whole have not had explained to them. And that battle is never ending. And if the great issue we want to know is, do the American people want to go into the last quarter of this century blind and deaf? Because we have a situation we've never had before. The United States has always had months or years and thousands of miles of ocean to get ready. That's gone.
Sir,
if our leaders are going to make the right decisions, they've got to have the right information and plenty of time in advance, or they'll make the wrong decisions.
You are a very powerful advocate. I wonder if you are as persuasive in German, Russian, or French as you are in English.
I would not be interested in persuading any of them. I would hope to persuade the American people that if they don't defend themselves, their freedom won't survive.
We've got to pause again. We'll take care of some commercials quickly. And then I've held you for rather a long time on just the last few years of your career, your years in the CIA. I want to get to those other earlier years in which so much of great interest happened to you and where you were, in fact, a participant observer at some very important moments in our history, particularly our international relations history. And so, we'll be right back to General Vernon Walters after these words. I, General Walters, am ready to get to the younger Walters when he was lieutenant, captain, major, lieutenant, colonel, and so on, and served with the Brazilian Expeditionary Force in Italy, served as General Clark's aide, served then as attaché, military attaché, back in Brazil, attended the Bogota Conference and helped protect General Marshall from assassination, served in Paris helping to administer the Marshall Plan, and that in close coordination with Averell Harriman, went to Iran with Averell Harriman and the dealings with Premier Mossadegh, served with General Eisenhower at NATO headquarters at Shape, traveled with President Nixon when he was vice president to South America, and on and on and on. And then, of course, dealing with the Vietnamese and the Chinese in Paris, the intelligence operations in Vietnam itself, and all the rest. We just can't do justice to this rich and exciting career of yours, but I know that there's one leftover point that you're eager to make with regard to the CIA.
Yeah, I don't want people to think that I advocate a CIA free of all controls. I don't. I can't tell you that in those 80,000 people, there weren't some kooks, some nuts, and some people who used bad judgment. Obviously, there were, and anybody who deals with large numbers of people knows that you do. I think the way to handle this is not the way we handle it at present, by reporting everything to 7 different committees of the House, 7 different committees of the Senate, which comprise half the membership. I think we should have a joint committee to oversee the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the NSA, and the other intelligence parts of the community, comprised of members of the House and members of the Senate. The Atomic Energy Joint Committee has never had leaks. It's been highly effective in supervising all of our atomic energy efforts, and it's worked very effectively. And I think if we could have a group like that overseeing the matter, we would not have the problems of leaks that we've had in the past. But I don't want people to get the impression that I'm saying that there haven't been some nuts and some kooks. There have.
Selecting just one occasion from your long, exciting career, let me turn your attention to that Bogota conference, 1948 in Bogota, Colombia, I think the seventh meeting of the Pan-American Congress. Our Secretary of State, General George Marshall, was down there together with a very distinguished delegation. You were attached to them as translator and I think also exercising some important intelligence functions. And the city blew up, a kind of revolutionary takeover by leftists. And indeed, they were attacking the villas in which the various delegations were staying. Apparently, the man they were gunning for more than any other was General Marshall.
Among the foreigners, yes.
Were you aware at the time of an obscure Cuban student named Fidel Castro who supposedly was in those streets carrying a machine gun?
Not before the fact, but after it was reported that he was there and one of the chief agitators. What happened, of course, was that the leader of the opposition was assassinated on the street, and people blamed the government for it and immediately rose against the government. There was very bloody fighting. There were 1,000 people killed the first day. The second day was fairly quiet. The third day, I went down to church in the morning and got caught in a terrible fusillade and finally got back, quite happy to be back, and then I saw Averill Harriman getting ready to go out and hoped he wasn't planning on taking me, but unfortunately he was. We went down to the president's office, and there was shooting going on in the streets, and I must say he never even looked up from some economic report he was reading. We got to the president's, and he told me to bang on the door. There was no sentry in the door. And a butler opened with a Tommy gun and white tie. And Mr. Harriman, without flinching, handed him his hat. The guy fumbled with a hat and the Tommy gun. As it turned out, when we finally got to the president, he told us he'd invited 24 guests for lunch, and Mr. Harriman was the only one who had shown up.
Not many years after that, you're back in South America traveling with Vice President Nixon
right.
in Caracas, Venezuela.
Right.
I guess you're in the car when they try to kill
right.
him.
Yes. He was sitting on the right-hand side of the car with a Secret Service man on the jump seat. I was sitting on the jump seat in front of the Venezuelan foreign minister. And we had been spat upon at the airport. There were neither police nor troops there. It was a very unusual thing. There was no effort made to hold the hostile mobs away from us. Now, the United States, and this is a curious thing...
You think the Venezuelan government was trying to tell us something?
Well, they just emerged from a long dictatorship, and they didn't want to put a lot of uniforms in the street. A military dictatorship, and they didn't want to put a lot of uniforms in the street. But just about that time, the United States took some action of restricting Venezuelan petroleum imports, which caused some people there to lose their jobs, and that irritated them. And we started to ride up to Caracas, and about just short of the build-up area, there were two cars parked across the superhighway, and the central divider was so high you couldn't get across it. So we stopped, and immediately a mob came out from the woods on both sides of the road with baseball bats and iron pipes and began beating on the car. And if you've ever been inside a car with people doing it, it's like being inside a bass drum.
I'm happy to say I never have been.
Well, anyway, the Secret Service guy on the jump seat in front of Mr. Nixon pulled out his pistol and said, "Let's shoot some of these so-and-sos and get out of here." And Mr. Nixon said, "Put that away. When they open that door and drag me into the street, if I tell you, but only if I tell you, do you use it?" And at that moment, I looked out of my window and I saw a stone coming and it hit the window and I got a mouth and a face full of glass. And Mr. Nixon said, "Are you hurt?" And I turned around and I said, "I don't think so." He said, "Walters, spit out that glass. I have a lot more to say to these people today." And in fact, the newspapers reported that I was cut in the mouth, and one of my friends commented, "Yes, it was open and he was talking as usual. Where else do you think he'd be injured?" Hmm. We finally got away from that. We were going to Bolivar's tomb. And I looked up this long, narrow, I believe President Carter went there the day before yesterday, at this very hostile mob, and I said to him, "Mr. Vice President, you can't go to Bolivar's tomb." And he said, "Well, do you know the city? Where can we go?" I said, "If we turn off here, we'll be off the published itinerary. And we can go to the American Embassy at the top of that hill, and they'll be out of breath when they get up there." He said, "Tell the driver to turn." And the Venezuelan foreign minister said, "But this is madness. We won't have any escort." And I was pretty fed up, and I turned around and I said, "Mr. Minister, where is our escort?" In Spanish. And Mr. Nixon then said, "Walter, stop all this negotiating in Spanish and tell that driver to turn right." We turned right. I mean, I said to the Irvin Committee, "I can't tell you that I don't admire Mr. Nixon's courage." I do. I saw him under circumstances twice where his life was in danger, and he behaved with great courage, which is why I find it somewhat difficult to believe these stories of him crawling on the floor of the White House and talking to the pictures. I think there's a little poetic imagination there.
There are so many fascinating scenes in your book, Silent Missions. I'm very happy to say to our audience that it's a book that I would commend to anybody who's interested in a rich and complex life that was lived through with full vigor, and I rather get the feeling with full enjoyment. I think, being a witness to history, you rather enjoyed your vantage point.
Yes.
One scene that I will cherish from this book is that famous conference in Paris. What is the year? 1960.
Yes.
Four-power meeting, which was scheduled before Gary Powers was shot down, and which then went on, stayed on schedule, even though the whole U2 incident had exploded, and Mr. Khrushchev destroyed the conference. And the fascinating figures in your account, and you were sitting there as a translator, are not only Khrushchev, but also de Gaulle, who comes through magnificently.
Yes. Well, first of all, you're right, I did enjoy it. And I do consider that I've gotten back from the United States far more than I've ever given it. One of the reasons I wrote the book, quite frankly, was to share the enjoyment. I was lucky enough to have an exciting and adventurous life, and I wanted to share it with people. And also, I've not tried to rewrite history or to compete with historians. I've tried to shed some light that has not yet been shed on a number of events that I was present at. And it's not to compete with historians, it's to show a human light of a lot of things.
But these are, many of them, very rich footnotes to history, particularly as they illuminate the nature of the great actors of contemporary history.
Well, one thing I was always grateful for, I never got so blasé that I wasn't impressed by being in the presence of the great. For instance, I never walked into the Oval Office under any president that I didn't realize that I was standing at the seat of one of the great...
Did Khrushchev seem to you in any sense great at that particular meeting?
No, not at that meeting, but I must tell you that, quite frankly, I think Mr. Khrushchev will go down in history because he opened doors that had been closed by Stalin up to then. Stalin, to my knowledge, only went to Finland once in his whole life outside the boundaries of Russia. Khrushchev had traveled, and he had some sense of proportion. He permitted a contact that it hasn't solved all our problems, but we've been able to talk to the Russians since
Khrushchev.
But he
didn't see all the places he really wanted to get to.
No.
You remember his peak
Disneyland.
That he didn't get to Disneyland, exactly.
No. But he was a man with more vision on the outside world. But it was interesting, because at the time of the first conference where I saw him in Geneva in 1956, he was not the titular head of the government, but there was no question, if you looked at the delegation, who was running it. But there was one very amusing episode, and you're right, de Gaulle dominated that conference. But there was one very amusing episode. Khrushchev was trembling as he read the statement. He was obviously under great stress. He stood up and he read the statement. His hands were trembling visibly.
And that was the one in which he demanded an apology.
Apology
from President
Eisenhower. At one time, at one moment, de Gaulle said to him, to turn to the Russian interpreter and said, tell the chairman that the acoustics in this room are excellent. There's no room for him, no need for him to raise his voice. And the Russian interpreter turned white. And de Gaulle turned to his own interpreter, who was the son of a Russian prince. And with great gusto, he translated. Khrushchev looked furiously over his glasses at de Gaulle and went on reading, but in a lower tone. But at one point, he got very excited and said, I've been overflown. And de Gaulle interrupted him and said, so have I. And Khrushchev said, by your American allies. And de Gaulle said, no, by you. 18 times yesterday, a Russian satellite crossed the sky of France without my permission. How do I know you didn't have cameras in it? And a beatific look came over Khrushchev's face. He raised his hands and his eyes to heaven, and he said in Russian, Bog minya vidit moi ruki chesti. God sees me. My hands are clean. You don't think I'd do a thing like that. And de Gaulle said, well, how did you show us those pictures of the far side of the moon, which you showed us with such justifiable pride? And Khrushchev said, oh, well, in that one I had cameras. And de Gaulle said, I see. In that one you had cameras. Proceed.
Yes. Beautifully done. Great style.
No.
You have a whole chapter in the book about de Gaulle.
Yes, it was a fascinating...
You observed him from quite early on in his career.
As a first lieutenant, I took him a letter in London in December 1942. And on and off, I saw him until shortly before his death, when I took a letter from Mr. Nixon to General de Gaulle, who had resigned as president of France. Previously, President Nixon had invited him to come to the United States. And obviously, since he was no longer president, that invitation was no longer valid. But Mr. Nixon sent me a handwritten letter to de Gaulle, renewing to General de Gaulle the invitation he had previously extended to the president of France. And de Gaulle was very moved by this, and he sat down and wrote a letter in his own hand back saying, I'd like to sometime. And that covered a period of 28 years, my relationship with him and various meetings, which I've tried to recount in the book under various circumstances.
You've known most of the great figures in contemporary history, most of the leaders of the great nations and the foreign secretaries and the leading diplomats and, of course, the leading military. Who stands out? This is almost a Reader's Digest sort of question, but I think it's not an inappropriate one. Who stands out to you as the one or perhaps the two or three truly most unforgettable and truly most impressive men?
Well, obviously, you couldn't go without Churchill. I mean, I never... Curiously, I translated for Churchill on several occasions, but with... I wasn't British, but I translated once with the Brazilians with him and once with the French. I would say... The list is fairly large. I would say Churchill... Americans, I would say it's a close toss-up between Truman and Eisenhower, who didn't like one another. And de Gaulle, who really was, who radiated an extraordinary sense of power and assurance and everything else. And I mean, he'd make me so furious sometimes, equating the United States with the Soviet Union as a threat. But there's an interesting background to that. In 1952, General Eisenhower saw him just before he left the NATO command. De Gaulle was the head of the opposition in France. De Gaulle said to him, you're going to become president of the United States, and I'm going to become president of France. And he said, when that happens, I'm going to have to say things that will offend Americans and you. But you must remember why I'm doing it. I'm taking a nation which was once great and has fallen very low, and I have to lash them with words to take their own responsibility for their own defense. And when someone reports to you that I've said one of these terrible things, bear that in mind. And then alongside of that, when Khrushchev stormed out of the U-2 meeting, uttering the direst threats, de Gaulle took Eisenhower by one arm and me by an arm and led us to a corner. And he said, I don't know what Mr. Khrushchev is going to do or what's going to happen, but whatever he does and whatever happens, I want you to know that we will be with you to the end. I was astounded at this unconditional expression of support.
Let me pause for a second to say that this is WGN, Clear Channel Radio from Chicago. Our guest tonight, Lieutenant General Vernon Walters, the former Deputy Director of the CIA. And our phone number, because we will be onto the phones in just a few minutes, is, as usual, 591-7200, 591-7200. If you're calling long distance, the area code 312. One fascinating scene, one of the many fascinating scenes, and you give a chapter to it in Silent Missions, is the meeting of President Truman and General MacArthur on Wake Island. He deserved it, didn't he?
Yes. Although, do not put me in the position of not saying he was a great general. I think he was perhaps the greatest American military commander since Robert E. Lee from a purely military point of view. But he didn't understand the fundamental fact that the president runs the United States, even if he's wrong. As I said in the book, the men were in conflict. In a sense, both of them were right. But the way the United States is run, one of them had to go, and it had to be MacArthur. That meeting was a fascinating one. I went with Governor Harriman, Averill Harriman, who was special assistant to Mr. Truman. And we arrived about a half an hour before Mr. Truman. It was still dark when we landed on the island. And in the plane with Mr. Harriman was Mr. Pace, the Secretary of the Army, and General Bradley, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Now, General Bradley may have been a cadet at West Point when General MacArthur was a general, but the way the United States is organized, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs is senior to anybody in the armed services. So I was a little surprised as we got out of the airplane. We looked around for General MacArthur. We knew he was already on the ground. That television show that showed him keeping Mr. Truman waiting in the air is nonsense. It didn't happen.
Truman claims that it did.
No, Truman doesn't claim that.
In his...
Somebody else claims it, not Mr. Truman.
Well, in the book, based upon his conversations with...
Yes, but I think somebody's recollection was faulty, and I think there are a lot of people who were there and can tell you what actually happened. Mr. Truman came in, General MacArthur had gotten there the night before, so there's no way he could have kept him. What the story originates from is this. As Mr. Truman's plane taxied up, the rest of us walked over to the foot of the steps to greet the president when he came down. The door of the plane opened, the ladder was rolled up, the two air policemen came down and stood at the foot of the steps. Mr. Truman appeared in the door and waved his hat. At that point, General MacArthur got up from his jeep and walked over just about the time Mr. Truman reached the ground, and they held out his hand. He did not salute. I was a young officer, and it surprised me because, you know, the Constitution is pretty specific. The president is the commander-in-chief, whether you voted for him or not. He is the commander-in-chief. And I noted this, but I didn't say anything. Mr. Truman gave no sign of anything. Years later, I saw Mr. Truman at Independence, and I said, Mr. President, can I ask you an indiscreet question? And he said, Walters, there are no indiscreet questions. There are only indiscreet answers, and I'm a specialist in them. What is it? I said, Mr. President, when you came down the ladder at Wake Island, did you notice? He cut me off. He said that MacArthur did not salute. You're damn right I did. And the other incident occurred in the meeting. The meeting was held in quite a small room with a low ceiling. And Mr. Truman sat everybody down around the table where he wanted them, and he could technically have put the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of the Army at his right, but he sat General MacArthur at his right. And General MacArthur took out his pipe, and he stuffed it, and he put it in his mouth, and he held up a box of matches. I remember this. It wasn't a lighter. And at the very last minute, he looked over his shoulder at Mr. Truman. He said, "You don't mind if I smoke, do you?" And things were so far along that it would have been very rude almost for the president to say no. And Mr. Truman, in a quiet voice, said, "Go right ahead, General. I've had more secondhand smoke blown in my face than any other man in America." But there was not, apart from that incident, MacArthur was very grateful for the support the president had given him. And there were no recriminations. He did not believe the Chinese would enter the war. Mr. Truman told him that all our intelligence support sources reported the Chinese were about to enter the war, and General MacArthur was confident that they wouldn't, and spent a great deal of time discussing the departure of divisions from Korea. He said, "The war will be over by Christmas, and I will give you 3 divisions for Europe in January." But I must say, in all fairness, that I think that he had a point. You see, Mr. Truman wanted to limit the conflict to the Korean Peninsula. General MacArthur felt that if we didn't win the war, we'd have others, and we eventually did in Vietnam.
We're going to pause once again, take care of some of those messages, and then we'll be right on to the telephones for your questions to General Vernon Walters. The number, 591-7200. Now's the time to give us a ring if you want to get in on this conversation. 591-7200, right back after this. We'll get on to the telephones for your questions to General Vernon Walters, whose new book, Silent Missions, has just been published by Doubleday. 591-7200 is our number. If you don't get through it first, we do hope you'll try again. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, Mr. Rosenberg.
Yes, sir.
I have 2 questions for General Walters. The second one, if you want to get back to, he seems very eager to want to talk about detente. And coming from a different viewpoint, I'd have several thoughts or questions for him. But the first one, I can't resist. It must seem that the nightmare of any intelligence officer has to be that of effectively translating intelligence into implementation of policy. Repeatedly, it seems that the failure of intelligence, aside from the question of false information, is how do you convince the leader or get the message to the leader of a nation that action must be taken or not taken on the basis of intelligence? Harrison Salisbury, in his 900 Days, spelled out graphically how Stalin had been warned 15 ways to Sunday about the impending German invasion, but simply did not want to believe it could happen. My question is, how do you deal with this, where there may be too much information, where the bureaucracy or advisors to a president may be filtering or hindering the flow of information, and how does a leader know what to believe?
Well, what happens is the president every day, at least in my time, I don't know how it is with President Carter, every morning with his first breakfast, he gets a condensation of the most important intelligence information. If we think he's really interested in his subject, we send along the raw information, the telegram that came in, so that he can see on what the condensed thing is based. One of the most difficult things with intelligence is not so much the collection of intelligence as the accurate interpretation of intelligence, preventing personal prejudice from growing in. Someone saying there's not going to be a war, and I don't care what the indications come in, it means there isn't going to be a war. And you're dealing with human beings, and there's no real guarantee against that. In a democratic society like ours, all you can do is put the information before the president, before whoever he wants to receive that information, which is generally people like the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, and the Secretary of the Treasury. Now, remember, it isn't just the CIA that's commenting on it. The Defense Intelligence Agency is commenting on it. The FBI is commenting on it. A great many people are commenting, so that he doesn't have just a single view coming to him. He's getting bulletins every morning from the CIA, from the DIA, from the NSA, which is the National Communications Outfit, from the FBI, from the American State Department, from the open sources of intelligence, from foreign broadcasts, and all the others. But you're right. It is very difficult, A, to have sufficient access to the president to be able to sit down and talk. He's so busy, for one thing, that it's hard to have an opportunity. But you have presidents who will check your morning bulletin and say, "Give me more on this," or "Send someone to talk to me about this," or "Give me a briefing on this." And, of course, the hardest thing to get is feedback from the president or from the secretaries. What interests them? What are we giving them that's useful? What are we giving them that's no use? What are we giving them too much of? These are things that you have to work out with the individuals, because it changes with the individuals and the type of his interest. But you are right. You have put your finger on one of the big problems, which is how you get the information. What you do, finally, if you have something really important, is you have a meeting, or in my time, of the U.S. Intelligence Board, of all the top intelligence agencies, and they work out a joint estimate that goes to the president. Now, some of them may disagree, and that disagreement is indicated by a footnote at the bottom, so that he gets the whole spectrum. Now, with failures, I would only point out this. When President Kennedy came out to CIA and talked to the people there, he said, "You are condemned to have your failures trumpeted and your successes passed over in silence."
I can't help but wonder from your explanation if to sift out and zero in on the important information, a new bureaucracy hasn't been created, which while in many instances may be helpful, in times of urgent and fast-breaking developments may in fact be a hindrance.
I don't think that's the case. For instance, the CIA, I can't go into the actual figures, but the CIA is a great deal smaller, and it's been going downhill in numbers since about 1966. It is much smaller now, and let me put it this way, it's an awful lot smaller than the Russian service.
Mm-hmm. Sir, we thank you very much for the call. Very interesting contribution indeed, and on to another. Good evening, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Good evening, Mills.
Go ahead, sir.
Am I on the air, Mr. General Walters?
Yes.
Pardon me, I have a slight cold. I am...
Me too.
That makes sense.
Also, sir, you've got your radio on. That's going to confuse us all. I think you ought to turn it down in a hurry.
I'll turn that down, yes. You're getting feedback. General Walters, I served under your command. I'm now retired. I would like to ask you a question on a military matter. In Israel and Jordan, what is your opinion of how best to solve that problem militarily, not politically? What do you think should be done over there?
Well, that's an opinion question. I think that the way to do it is to... there are various solutions that have been proposed. One is an independent Palestinian state, and one is a Palestinian state in some sort of federation with Jordan. Now, I would tend myself towards, and this may sound strange to you, an independent Palestinian state, and I'll tell you why. It would be a very small state. It would be sandwiched between Israel and Jordan. If you had it in federation with Jordan, I'm sure the PLO would try and overthrow King Hussein. And if they were in federation with him, it would be an internal affair and no one could stop them. If they were an external state, A, that both the Israelis and the Jordanians could bring pressure on them, and if they did anything against the Jordanian government, it would be a case of external aggression. Now, what the exact physical boundaries and so forth, I really don't know in detail. I've been out of the government for a year and a half. But I'll be honest with you, I'm very hopeful that they will arrive at a solution. I think the Arabs have been led to accept the existence of Israel and that nobody's going to drive the Jews into the sea. And I think the Israelis are thinking increasingly about what Ben-Gurion said, who was the founder of the state, in a sense, that security is more important than real estate.
Sir,
now, you have a rather long and distinguished career in the military, and I know that you do not remember me, but I did meet you once as a lieutenant colonel.
Well, I'm not going to ask you your name, but I'd try to.
We had to defend, and I wonder if Israel is going to be defensive or aggressive.
Well, I think they're anxious to work something out. You know, they've fought four wars in 30 years, and I think they must be pretty tired of it, and they would like to work out something. You know, the defense budget is an enormous burden on Israel. Israel has made the desert flower, but if Israel wasn't spending something like 60 or 70% of their national budget on arms, if they could get a solution that would be guaranteed by the United States, by Great Britain, by France, and by some other countries, they could devote some of the enormous creative energy in this country to making not only their own deserts bloom, but those of their neighbors.
Well, I think we all understand that, but I suppose that my question simply is, from a military standpoint, are they going to be the aggressors? Are they going to go after Lebanon and Syria and these places? And what will happen in the balance of power in the world, you know? As a general in the army, what do you think is going to happen?
I don't think they're going to go any further into Lebanon. I think they're going to turn that area over, and this is, again, I'm not reading government telegrams anymore. I'm a private citizen just like
right.
you. I think they're going to pull out of southern Lebanon. I think this was a sharp, angry reaction to that bus incident. I think they're going to turn that southern Lebanon area over to the United Nations. And I think they're going to pull out of there, and you see the Israeli defense minister is in Cairo today talking to Sadat. He's dead. Talking to Sadat, and I am hopeful that that common sense will prevail. They both need peace.
We will thank the caller. Pause again briefly and then right back to the telephones on 591-7200. 591-7200. Thank you very much, Jerry Golden. 591-7200 is the number if you're calling long distance, and we do encourage and give priority to long distance calls. The area code is 312, and then 591-7200. General Vernon Walters is our guest. The book in hand, and an excellent book it is Silent Missions, the publisher's Doubleday, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, General Walters.
Good evening.
I'd like your response to a couple of questions.
Try.
Number one, what prospects do you see for the CIA to regain some respect or preeminence under Stansfield Turner? And secondly, what sort of prospects would you see in the CIA for talented people wishing to serve, given the recent layoffs, et cetera?
Here's a young man considering a career, I think.
Just interested.
Right. You want me to answer now?
Sure.
I think the whole situation is a lot better than we've been led to believe by the media. At the time I left the CIA a year and a half ago, we had four times as many applicants as at any time previous to that. They have a tremendous program out there of having young people come in and spend a few weeks during their summer vacation working there and seeing whether they like it or not. And then after they graduate from college, they can come back. It's a place where there's probably the staff and faculty of 10 universities in academic degrees. It's
you know,
place.
One of my best graduate students disappeared into the CIA after he got his degree about 15 years ago, and he's still in there doing something.
A lot less secretive than it was. We have family day out there, and the families and the wives and the kids come out to see where their parents work and so forth and so on. I think there's enormous prospects for anybody who wants to be in on the vital and important things that are happening. The one thing I would like to do is try and dispel this atmosphere that it's some sort of mysterious and strange place. It's just as American as the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. And I'm not an old CIA man defending it, but all I can tell you is that the people out there live by the same standards of right and wrong, nearly all of them by the same standards of right and wrong as everybody else. And if I was a young man, I can tell you, I'd be real interested in going to work there.
Right. Well, my impression, though, is that the morale must be fairly low there now. There's been quite a few layoffs and there's been a lot of bad press.
Well, I tell you, as Mr. Truman once said, if you can't stand the heat, stay out of the kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And there are an awful lot of kitchen volunteers out there. You hear a lot of stories in the press and everything else, but I tell you, those are pretty steadfast and staunch people. And I was, as I say, I'm not an old CIA man. I'm an Army officer who went out there close to the end of my career. And those are pretty terrific people, and despite what you read, I see occasionally one or two of them, and it isn't all that bad. You know, the thrill of being in on all these tremendous technical achievements, of knowing in advance a lot of the things that are going to happen, it gives you a sense of contributing to the things that you believe in. And as I said once before, there is an invisible battlefield that the average person doesn't realize. And these people are there defending our freedom. And if they're not there, we're not going to be free.
Well, do you think this Stansfield Turner will be able to help, you know, in that respect?
Well, I don't want to criticize, you know, individuals and so forth and so on. It takes a while to settle in there. He came from outside the intelligence community. It's going to take him a while to learn. He's had a distinguished career until he came there. It doesn't mean I agree with everything he's done.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I found my own experience when I went there as an Army officer was to say them for about 6 months, and then I began saying we.
Okay.
And I don't know what the period is for him.
Thank you very much.
We thank you for the call, sir. And on to another. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. General, I'm an ex-naval officer as opposed to being an Army officer.
Right.
Transferred into intelligence late in my career, and I had the opportunity to be on Dr. Rosenberg's show once before.
Great.
Not as a caller on the show.
Oh, great.
That isn't the point, really. My question that I gave to the producer was, what do you consider desirable for the United States to have a secrecy act the way Great Britain did at one point?
Well, if you want my personal opinion, it would be highly desirable. If you want my pragmatic opinion, there's no chance whatever of getting it.
All right, I would agree with you on the first, and I'd have to agree with you on the second. The second point is that you've talked quite extensively about General MacArthur.
Yep.
Now, I can't help but agree with you as to his brilliance as a tactician and Army officer. But at one point in my naval career, I came across an officer who had been on the staff.
Yep.
Liaison work between the Navy and MacArthur's staff, and the comment that he had made off the record was that the intelligence officer on the staff was afraid, literally afraid of the man, to feed him the fact that the Chinese were just north of the Yalu River.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you hold that to be a possibility, or?
I think there's a possibility, but you must remember that General Willoughby, who was his chief of intelligence, had been through him all through the war and was on, you know, a pretty close relationship with him.
Mm-hmm.
I would tend to wonder about that. Again, it's a question of the interpretation of the collected intelligence. This is one of the most difficult areas. You get intelligence, and then you'll get very brilliant people, experts in the same matter, differing as to what it means.
Agreed.
And that is, as I say, to me, the hardest part of intelligence most people think is collecting it. I don't think so. I think it's the correct analysis. Because if you analyze it wrong, you're going to mislead the national leaders.
Mm-hmm. Well, Constantine Fitzgibbon, in his book, Secret Intelligence of the 20th Century, mm-hmm. Admitted that he had been out of the service, just as you have on a couple of occasions
yeah.
this evening, and ended up by saying he hoped that the U.S. government had something beside the CIA with all the publicity it's gotten.
Well, I can speak only up to the time that I left.
Right.
And the fact is that all of the stuff that had gone on had done relatively surprisingly little damage.
Yeah.
I just don't understand why it didn't do more. Really, as I went around the world and talked to the heads of friendly intelligence, their attitude was one of a sort of an indulgent parent with a child who's making a spectacle of itself.
Right.
I don't know how much time I have, but there's a marvelous story that the head of a friendly foreign intelligence service told me. He said that the three sailors were shipwrecked, and you as a former naval officer will understand this. He said three sailors were shipwrecked on an island in the Pacific. They were immediately captured by the cannibals. One was French, one was British, and one was American. And the king of the cannibals said, I have bad news and good news. The bad news is we're going to eat you for lunch tomorrow, and the good news is in the meantime I'll give you anything you want. So he turned to the Frenchman and he said, what do you want? And the Frenchman said, well, if you're going to kill me in the morning, I would just as soon spend my remaining hours with that beautiful cannibal girl over there, pointing to a cannibal girl. So they untied the Frenchman, and he and the cannibal girl disappeared into the woods. Then they said to the Englishman, what do you want? The Englishman said, I want a pen and paper. They said, what for? He said, to write a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations to protest against the unjust, unfair, and unsporting attitude you have taken towards us. So they untied the Englishman, they gave him a hut, and he started his Dear Mr. Waldheim letter. Then they turned to the American, and they said, what do you want? The American said, I want to be led into the middle of the village, I want to be made to kneel down, and I want the biggest cannibal here to kick me in the rear end. And the chief looked at his prime minister, and he said, I knew the Americans were weird, but I didn't think they were this weird, but since we've promised, we've got to do it. So they untied the American, led him into the middle of the village, made him kneel down, the biggest cannibal kicked him, knocked him down. As the American sprawled out, he pulled out a Tommy gun that he'd been hiding under his clothes, cut down the nearby cannibals, and the rest fled. Hearing the gunfire, the Frenchman and the Britisher came up, looked at him, and he said, you mean you've had that gun all the time? The American said, yes. And they said, well, why didn't you use it before now? And the American looked at them with a real hurt expression on his face. And he said, but you don't understand. It was not until they kicked me in the rear end that I had any moral justification for this sort of violence.
Beautiful story.
And there's, unfortunately, a national thing, but all quite seriously, I was amazed, up to the time I left, how relatively little damage. That's not telling you it hasn't done some damage. It has done a considerable amount of damage, but not as much as you would have expected from reading the newspapers.
Sir, with that, we will thank you very much for an interesting contribution.
Thanks.
General, before we get back to the phones, some of the lighter moments in your book, and there are lots of light moments, because there are some wonderful anecdotes which reveal people, in a sense, in even high and important figures in disarray and in confusion and in their humanness. But turning to you as the central figure, some of the lighter moments are the ones which reflect the translator's dilemma, and at times the translator's verging on the edge of catastrophe. There are one or two points in your book where you tell some stories on yourself which rather reminded me of that dismal fellow who was translating for President Carter in Warsaw and put his foot so firmly in his mouth. You've got a very interesting tale. Again, this involves De Gaulle, where you were translating between De Gaulle and Mark Clark, and you
yes.
made a very crucial error, didn't you?
Well, unfortunately, most of the errors I report in my book don't make me look very good. They make me look as though I had poor judgment or I was scared. And I'm afraid that in the cases I report upon, that is true. Yes, General De Gaulle came to see General Clark to discuss the withdrawal of the French troops from Italy to go into the south of France during the war. And I'd been told that he spoke no English, and being young and naive, I believed it. So after the discussion was going along, it was clear to me that he didn't understand English, because General Clark would say no, and General de Gaulle would ask me in French, what did he say? So I began throwing in some side comments.
Even though the word for no in French is
no. Almost
no.
the same. I would say, General de Gaulle says yes, but I don't think he really wants to do it. Or he says no, but I think if you push him a little harder, he'll do it. And he gave no sign of anything, and when we left, he stood up and he said in English, General Clark, we've had a very interesting conversation, and I hope that the next time we meet, it'll be on the liberated soil of France. So I stepped aside to let him out of the van, and I'm sure the print of my body is still visible. And as he went by, a wintry smile touched his lips. He tapped me on the shoulder, and he said, Walters, you did a very good job.
Did he ever recall that incident with you in later years?
Oh, yes, he did, 15 years later, and he named the village where it took place.
Yes, that's it. And then you were translating once for the foreign minister of France, Georges Bidault.
Yeah,
and,
well, that's a rather complicated story. But he was telling a story about literature, and General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, was replying. And that, no, Mr. Bidault said, there are authors that are very good in translation but worthless in the original, like Balzac. And the French foreign minister's name was Bidault, so when I translated that in English, I said, then there are writers that are good in translation but worthless in the original, like Bidault. And that was a very awkward moment for me. I mean, he laughed and took it very well, but it was an extremely awkward moment.
Of course, he was, in fact, an author, not merely a foreign minister.
He was an author with great pretensions to being an author, and I suppose he felt it was a Freudian slip or something else.
I think it was a Freudian slip.
No, I felt rather... I had another incident with Mr. Bidault several years later, which was quite interesting. It was at the Bermuda Conference with General Eisenhower and Churchill. And Bidault, the French were then involved in their war in Indochina, and was asking for help. And Churchill was rather roughly, no, that's your problem, you've got to solve it. And then all of a sudden he realized he'd been very rough with Bidault. And he said, let us never forget that Mr. Bidault was the president of the National Committee of Resistance inside occupied France for 4 years. And when dawned the day of glory of which the Marseillaise spoke, after spending those 4 years in mortal danger of his life for every hour of every day and every night, he was waiting for us beneath the Arch of Triumph. And his voice was sobbing, and Bidault was sobbing, and everybody was sobbing. And then the British Foreign Minister, Anthony Eden, said, George, after a bouquet like that, you have to do something. And it broke the magic of the moment.
Beautiful. 591-7200 is our phone number. This is WGN, Clear Channel Radio from Chicago. We'll be right back after these messages. Lieutenant General Vernon A. Walters, whose new book is titled Secret Missions. 591...
Silent.
Silent missions. Did I say secret? Well, of course, they were very often secret as well as silent, were they not? 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. I'd like to ask the General to speculate for a moment, considering his experiences in the intelligence community and his knowledge of world politics, as to whether or not the possibility of a nuclear confrontation between the, what we consider the East and West is an inevitability, or if there's some way it might be avoided in the future, and two, if it did happen, would the United States survive it as a nation?
I might climb onto that question and add a little extra point as well. The CIA, of course, is our major source, supposedly, of information about Soviet arms policy and actual Soviet deployments. And from the CIA, we've often had somewhat more sanguine estimates about what the Soviets are doing with strategic arms than we get from the Pentagon directly. There's been a little bit of a conflict between CIA and Pentagon when they're estimating just what Soviet megatonnage is or what their forward plans are.
That's true. First of all, in answer to the first question, I do not think it is at all inevitable. In fact, I think it is highly improbable. I think the Soviet effort is largely designed more as a chess game than a checker game. In other words, to face us with a very imposing force so that we will back off from the confrontation and let them do whatever they want. Would the U.S. survive? I certainly believe it would. I do not believe these doomsday prophecies. Life is very hardy, and man is the most tremendous, hardy, ferocious animal in the universe as far as we know, and he survived all kinds of disasters, and he's still there. Milt asked about the conflict. Well, I must say, in all truth, having spent time on both sides of the fence in military intelligence and the CIA, yes, the CIA has sometimes given more accurate information, and yes, the military have sometimes given more accurate information. Most recently, there was a conflict. The CIA thought that the Soviets were spending less on defense than the military did, and then we got a source that proved definitively that the military were right and the Soviets were spending more. So I can't give you any percentages from this, but you can't. Obviously, the people that tell the Congress that what's going to cost them the least money are necessarily the most popular.
I'd like to pose another question on the issue of the Russians as far as strategic weapons and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I read an article in a publication recently, I think it was even Reader's Digest, to the effect that the Russian civil defense system is... according to the article, it was established as a separate branch of their military services.
That's correct.
That the civil defense system in Russia is or could cut into our deterrent value quite a bit. And I wonder if you'd like to comment on that and whether or not we should establish a branch of our military services the same way.
It is true, what they call DOSARM and DOSAF, which are the civil defense arms of the Red Army and the Red Air Force, are very large. They are very widespread. In a totalitarian society like theirs, you know, you get everybody into it, and it's a tremendously politically important thing.
Uh-huh.
It's I don't want to compare it because it's not exactly the same as the National Guard, but it has the same kind of local implications and so forth.
Uh-huh.
Whether it would really preserve a large enough percentage of the Soviet population from destruction to make it a worthwhile gamble for them for nuclear war, I don't think so.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thank you very much.
Isn't it true as well, General, that most of their civil defense planning is on paper and is in bureaucratic structure rather than hard shelters in the ground?
No, it is not. There are large numbers of shelters. There are huge grain storage things. There are very important fuel storage tanks. No, I would like to be able to say that, but there is hard evidence to the contrary that there is a lot of shelter work done. For instance, all the Soviet subway stations have blast doors on them to supposedly to resist nuclear overpressure.
With that, back to the telephones. Here's a long-distance call. Where are you calling from, please?
Kansas, Hillsboro, Kansas.
Okay, go ahead.
General?
Yes?
I would like to ask you a question.
Go ahead.
And I would like to seek an answer from a military point of view.
Right.
What do you feel our position should be with respect to our capacity to produce food and fiber, and I'd like for you to address that from an intelligence point of view?
Well, I think under normal conditions, food gives you tremendous power. However, when you're facing a state like the Soviet Union, which once starved 5 million of its own people to death, it does not have the same kind of leverage that it could be expected to have with a democratic state.
That was in the language of Stalin, the liquidation
yes.
of the kulaks as
the
a kulaks. Class.
Yes. They are quite willing to subject their people to this kind of suffering, and if we did not sell them certain foodstuffs, I think they would just obviously they'd try and find them somewhere else, but if they didn't, they'd just do without. So while it would give you great leverage in dealing with, say, a Western European or a South American state or a Near East or Middle Eastern state, I'm not sure with a country as large as the Soviet Union with enough margin in its economy to simply put its people on rations if they had to, that it has the same leverage value that it would have elsewhere. I'm told, and you're from Kansas, and I'd like to know whether this is true, someone told me that somewhere on the Kansas-Missouri border, there's a large sign which says, "Welcome to Kansas, the breadbasket of the Soviet Union."
That's correct, sir.
Well, it's interesting that we, who have infinitely less people working on the farm, have enough food to sell to other people, and that they, with an acreage, a cultivable acreage, three times ours, 60 years after the revolution, are still unable to feed their own people.
That is interesting. General, would you feel, sir, that there might be advantage for us to keep secret, shall we say, the figures as to what we produce and et cetera?
I think it's very hard to do. With a highly developed photographic and technological means, it's pretty hard to do, to hide the stocks and the thing and the state of the crop and everything else. I mean, I don't want to get into a rather delicate area,
sure.
But it's very difficult to hide for any nation today with the technological systems that are in the world to hide a ballpark estimate of what their crop is.
Yeah. Well, in light of that, General, we would expect with the great leverage we have and with our excess food and fiber that we quite possibly could use this to a very peaceful end someday. In negotiations, as shall we not? I don't want to use the word clout, but as a means for negotiating a peace.
Well, I think that's true, and I think it's not just the stocks; it's how we do it that almost nobody understands.
Yes.
How do we produce this much on so little land?
That brings us to a new and different challenge when we arrive at that point of using our food and fiber to not necessarily starve people to death, but to use it as a carrot, shall we say, to negotiating maybe a lasting peace at some point in the world.
I think that's true. I think it could be very helpful in that respect.
Sir, we thank you. Very
yes,
good
sir,
contribution.
Thank you.
Good night. Hello, you are on the air.
Hello.
Yes,
yes?
Sir.
My question is just an opinion question I'd like to ask the general.
Go right ahead.
Sir, for 15 months of the little over 3 years that I was in a service, I was at first a para infantry instructor, and when we ran out of troops, they had to send the instructors.
Yep.
We were a deep recon outfit, and every once in a while, we, you know, we contact each other and get together, and our general consensus reached a point I would like to ask your opinion on. First of all, I'd like to ask you, did you read Colonel Corson's book on the Vietnam War entitled Betrayal?
No, I did not.
Well, you missed a goodie, but nonetheless, when President Roosevelt was in power, mm-hmm. every morning, or every morning that it was humanly possible, he would have a staff conference with General Marshall.
Yep.
And he, being the commander-in-chief, would say, here is what I want politically. Can you do it militarily? And General Marshall, being the general, the army man, the man who knew, you know, what was going on, would give him an answer as soon as he could, yes or no, or maybe. Now, when President Truman fired General MacArthur,
mm-hmm.
he set up, in our opinion at least, and in the opinion of most of us that have talked it over, he set up a precedent, perhaps unwittingly. He was asked, if you recall, why didn't you drop the atomic bombs out at sea and just tell the people that the next one is going down the Emperor's chimney unless you stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And his reply to that was, well, we didn't know if they'd go off.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounded so asinine because he didn't have to tell anybody if they'd go off.
Mm-hmm.
But when he fired MacArthur, it seems now we've had this lunacy of Johnson, we've had the lunacy of Kennedy at the Bay of Pigs, although I give them credit for taking the blame for it. They pick the shots. They call the military hardware. They make the plans. Now, I want your opinion. Would it be more, wait a minute, I phrased that wrong. Did, in your opinion, President Truman set a precedent when he fired the commander-in-chief?
What you're objecting to, I gather,
no.
sir, is that the military be at all limited by the civilian executive who supposedly is the commander-in-chief.
Yes, sir. I've met military commanders who were frightened make their own decision.
Yeah. No, I don't think he set a precedent. After all, Mr. Lincoln changed generals a number of times during the Civil War. We changed generals during the Mexican War. The fact is, in a democratic society like ours, regardless of whether the general is right or wrong, the president does have the power to fire him. And not just in the United States. That's true in every country in the world.
Yes, sir, I'm aware of that. But this was an extraordinary example. It was even brought up in Che Guevara's diaries that were found.
Mm-hmm.
That he said, we'll have a north and a south and an east and a west, and we'll bleed you to death. And that was before the Holocaust in Vietnam.
Sir, yeah. I must interpose because we've got to pause for some commercials. I do thank you very much for the call. It seems to me, General, that any high American military would have to disagree with the import of that call, because if you play it through all the way, what this caller is suggesting is that the military, finally, if the pursuit of political aims involves military means, the military finally should determine how those aims are to be pursued.
Wow.
Whereas in the great American military tradition, it's always clearly understood that the military serve the civilian executive.
I think that's correct, but I think we did, in Vietnam and Korea, get a little beyond that, and the executive began getting into tactical details. To a degree that I don't think is helpful. I think there's no question the civil authority must decide the size of the war, the general policies to perceive, but when you have the civil authority prescribing the altitude at which aircraft bombings are going in, or which battalion or which regiment's going to go somewhere, I think we've gotten things a little bit out of skelter in a situation like that. But there's no question that the president, who was the commander-in-chief, could fire anybody in the armed services.
With that, we'll pause for a last round of commercials. Back for a few more telephone calls after that on 591-7200. General, before we get back to the phones, there are many fascinating characters in your book, Silent Missions. Some of the most silent missions that you were involved in were run by and or for Henry Kissinger.
Right.
Particularly those secret negotiations with the Vietnamese and with the Chinese.
Yeah.
Can you illuminate for us the character and your estimate of the achievement of Henry Kissinger himself?
Well, I say in the book, in a number of places, that I didn't always agree with Dr. Kissinger. I argued with him once or twice, in the degree that he was my chief. I mean, in the sense that hierarchically, in the structure of the U.S. government, he was above me, and I'd been told by the president to carry out his instructions. But I would say Henry Kissinger had a rather unique sense a vision of imagination. He had a plan. He wasn't always able to carry it out, but he didn't stumble from crisis to crisis. He had some sort of an overall plan. He had extraordinary patience and tenacity. Sit there for 3 years listening to those Vietnamese saying the imperialist reactionary circles of Wall Street who control the United States. And every now and then he'd lose his temper and say, why don't you save that for the public discussions where it has some impact and don't waste my time with it. I've come a long way to talk serious things with you. My impression of him is very positive. As I say, when I felt irritated with him, I'd try and think who could do the job half as well, and I couldn't come up with any names.
You had quite a problem sneaking him in and out of Paris.
Oh, yes.
I suppose 30 or 40 different occasions.
Yes.
Why did he always have to be undercover as he went?
Because both the Chinese and the North Vietnamese had told us that if there was any publicity concerning the discussions with him, they would break off the negotiations. So I had to bring him in by airplane, sometimes to England, sometimes to Germany, sometimes to France itself, and then move him quietly to Paris. I must say, one of the great satisfactions of my career, however, was he came once publicly, and the newspapers all speculated that he was going to meet the North Vietnamese, and when he left from that public visit, they said a 24-hour watch on the embassy shows that he never left the building, except that he did twice with me and got back in, and not even his Secret Service man knew that he'd been out of the building.
Now that you're retired, and if you didn't have the high moral concerns that you do, you could probably have a pretty interesting second career as a smuggler.
Yeah, except that I had the complicity of the President of France on one occasion, who loaned me his airplane to pick up Henry Kissinger from an airport in Germany where he'd made a forced landing and get him into Paris without anybody finding him.
Let's work in one more quick telephone call. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening, Milt. I enjoyed your program tremendously tonight. The General presents what I would term a wholesome, patriotic viewpoint of the CIA, and I'd dearly like to believe it. My question basically is this. In the transition from the OSS, which I think most Americans perceived as a very wholesome, patriotic thing, to the CIA, the leading consultant to the CIA was head of British intelligence, and I worked in Washington a very minor capacity in this period, and he ended up being one of the biggest double agents in the history of the world, defecting to Russia.
That was Ken Philby.
Right.
Well, he wasn't head of British intelligence.
He wasn't head of British intelligence.
Well, all right. Please indulge me in that respect.
Sure.
But I guess what I'm trying to get at is I think that from a gossipy standpoint, if you wish, a lot of Americans perceive the CIA as being born in sin and therefore has been a bad deal from the word go. And with your perception and expertise in this area, I think if you had addressed yourself to this, you could do an awful lot to either relieve my fears in this area or perhaps make me feel a lot better about the whole situation.
With one limit that I fear I must impose, we've only got about 2 minutes left,
well,
General.
Well, quite quickly, if that is the perception, then the KGB has been very successful with its disinformation. In fact, one of the things that concerns me is their ability to present to the American people as the real threat to their freedom coming from the CIA and the FBI rather than from the mightiest military establishment in world history of the Red Army, Air Force, and Navy. All I can tell you is that I personally happen to believe in a personal God before whom I will have to stand one day to account for everything I've done or failed to do. And all I can tell you is that in the 4.5 years I was at the CIA, I was never asked, with a single exception of the Watergate, to order, condone, tolerate, or go along with anything that in any way violated the principles up to which I try, not always successfully, to live.
Sir, we are virtually out of time. I thank you very much for the call.
Thank you for your time.
The little bit of time left, I suppose I just want to ask you, and in this I'm indulging my own voyeuristic curiosity, was it a really satisfying career? And if it was, don't you miss it some? What are you doing now, and how are you making up for what must be a sort of vacuum left in your daily experience?
Well, I expected that vacuum, but I haven't found it. Curiously, I decided to write. And I've written my first book. I'm writing another book. I've done a lot of research. It's taken me many places around the world. But I can just sum it up quickly. It has been a rewarding career. I came into the Army 37 years ago as a young private. Most of my adult life has been spent in the service of my country and its army. They have rewarded me beyond the wildest dreams of the young private of 1941, and I have loved them both more than the written or spoken word can convey.
Where do you live now?
I live in Washington and in Florida, both.
And essentially, you're engaged in a writing career. Actually, I've been informed that you've done a novel, and that strikes
me as
rather an unusual turn for general retired from the American Army to do.
Well,
though, to be sure, the man who wrote Ben-Hur was a general.
Lew Wallace. I want to beat him out. He only wrote one book, and I want to write several. Basically, age has caused me to, not I don't feel badly, but the laws on retirement have caused me to lay down my sword, and now I've picked up my pen, and I find it just as sharp.
The novel, of course, must be an espionage thriller.
No,
it would have to be
espionage.
In that genre.
It's about the boat people who are fleeing the communist terror in Vietnam right now. The 5,000 a month who are coming out in open boats.
By the way, we literally have just about 45 seconds left, but one of the great tragedies of the present moment is what we're beginning to hear about the Cambodian extermination program. The Cambodian elite against its own people.
It's the greatest genocide since Hitler's death camps.
Do you have confirming information
on
that?
But in Vietnam, they've got 250,000 people. By comparison with the Cambodians, they look good. But they've got 250,000 people in thought reform camps, and not many are coming back alive. When you have a totalitarian dictatorship, this is what they've got to do to stay in power.
General, you're a very interesting man, and to be sure, an excellent author. If your coming novel is as good, as fascinating as Silent Missions, your first book, why then I'm going to look forward to that novel as well. Silent Missions is published by Doubleday. Our guest has been General Vernon A. Walters. And, sir, I thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Milt.
The program was produced by Marcia Cassidy. We'll be back with you again on Monday night.